the truth that empowers. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
It's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to talk about the latest on health and healing, including linking a better brain function and delayed dementia with simply better, healthier choices we make from research from York University. From Tufts University, I'm going to talk about what is called beta-cryptoxanthin. Now, that's a carotenoid. And what does it do? Really helps people who've quit smoking not develop lung cancer. And then a really good study from Columbia University School of Public Health talks about fruits and vegetables may slow Alzheimer's disease. And then something we rarely eat here, but it sure is popular in the Middle East, tamarind. What can it do? It can remove fluoride from your body and reduce the risk of chronic disease, and much more on health and nutrition. From our environmental segment today, a major cover-up on Fukushima is uncovered by Robert Hunziker from Counterpunch. And also, climate change could flip the Mediterranean lands into desert. And we're talking about now. Who says? Nature magazine in a major study. And also West Antarctica begins to destabilize with, quote, intense unbalanced melting from Eric Roston of Bloomberg. That means that we could get flooding a lot sooner and a lot worse than what anyone had expected. Also today, I am going to be sharing a letter to Michael Moore and those who support Michael's philosophy of supporting Hillary Clinton. And I'm sharing my own views, as well as Professor Henry Giroux, on looking at it from this perspective: what are you really voting for? And then I'll get into some of the dynamics of using Michael's films as an example of what we should be believing in, because I believe on so many of the things he's done, he's been on the right side of history and truth. Then how does that reconcile with him supporting someone who's just the opposite of everything that he has done in his career and believes in? So I'm holding up a mirror to the entire left that believes that somehow you can end neo-fascism with neoliberalism. That's not possible, but we'll discuss that. Then, if time permits, I will share either today or tomorrow an in-depth, original, investigative reporting white paper called The Toxic Science of Flu Vaccines. And this shows you why there is absolutely no good science to justify getting a flu shot, but a lot of good science as to why you should be concerned if you do get one. This is fully vetted, fully scientifically referenced. It is published as of right now on the Progressive Radio Network website with hundreds of other articles that have been published today by categories. And so if I don't get it today, at least you can download it and read it and share it. Also, I don't know if I'll have time, but I want to talk about the world that we are watching. In other words, we want to look at some of the issues closer, not superficially. I won't say more than that until I get into them. So let's begin, since we have so much to share. First up, I'm looking at a study from York University, that's in Canada, that talks about how the healthier the choices you make, such as, quote, eating plenty of fruits and vegetables, combined with regular exercise, leads to better cognitive function for younger and older adults and may delay the onset of dementia. And this was done by a team at the university. They examined 45,522 participants, ages 30 to 80, over a period of years. And they found, quote, that eating more than 10 servings of fruits and vegetables daily was linked with better cognitive function. When moderate exercise was added, those eating less than 5 servings reported better cognitive function. So here's what I would add to this good study. I believe that we should be consuming 14 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, minimally, organic, and those could also be consumed as juices. So if you had a 1 glass of juice at 16 ounces, that's equivalent to 2 full servings of either fruits or vegetables, because when you juice, you're eliminating the fiber and you're getting water. And your water represents almost 72% of the entire body, some organs more, some less. But it's our number one nutrient that we take in. Oxygen is our number one survival element, but water is what we need. You start hydrating the body, suddenly pain goes away. You're able to flush lactic acid out of your joints. Athletes who have burn, which is lactic acid after an exercise, they find that flushed out. It's just terrific for you in all levels. Less constipation, less inflammation in your joints, arthritis is a lot less, fibromyalgia is less, even your brain functions better when you're hydrated. But hydrating with healthy juices is 10 times better than hydrating with tap water. So what they're saying is, 10 servings, well, it used to be 6 servings. So they're saying 10, and I'm saying, good, start, now get up to where all the real good science is. Now, moderate exercise is good, no question about that. But exercising for an hour a day, combining aerobic and resistance, is even better. So the more you exercise, but not beyond a certain amount. For example, I was training this past Sunday with our running and walking club in Central Park, and it's packed because of all the people doing the marathon. And I remember just a few years ago, for over 30 straight years, almost 40 straight years, I'd be out there training for the marathon, either New York or one of the others. And it was just common to do 60 to 70 miles a week and heavy training for the World Games up to 100 miles a week. That was both positive, but it was also destructive, because all running more than 6 miles is immunosuppressive. You're building tremendous amounts of free radicals. Now, if you're wise, you take antioxidants before and after your workout, which traps the free radicals due to the breathing. The breathing creates oxidative stress. The inhale, exhale, you just created free radicals. In fact, running around the park just 6 miles gives you just about the same number of free radicals if you were to smoke a pack of cigarettes. But because you're also more likely to be making other healthier choices, like taking vitamin C, vitamin E, coenzyme Q10, which traps the free radicals, then you've gotten the benefit of the exercise, but you haven't gotten the debilitation. I remember a fellow I used to train with, very nice guy, very pleasant, but he always ran the same distance at the same pace every single morning, 7 days a week. And I asked him, I said, why are you running 13 miles every day at a 6-minute pace? He said, well, it's so easy. That's what I like doing. He never raced. He was not a racer. And one day on one of these training sessions, I joined him. And the entire time, I explained what actually is happening at the cellular level. And I said, you may be 35 years old now chronologically, but your leg muscles are going to be about 70. So one day you're going to wake up, and you're going to go out for a workout, and you're not going to be able to do an 8-mile, let alone 6. And you're not going to be able to do 13 miles, and you're lucky to do 3. He just laughed. 10 years later, I hadn't seen him about 5 years. Coming out of a movie at Lincoln Plaza, and there he was, coming out one of the concerts. And we chatted for a moment, and I said, how's it going? How's the training going? Oh, I can't train anymore. Why not? Well, it's one of those strange things. The doctors can find nothing physically wrong with my legs, but I can't go out and do it. In fact, I'm into power walking now, because that I can do. And he said, I guess you were right about that. And I said, yes, when you're training more than what your body benefits, you're actually immunosuppressing the body. You're prematurely aging your cells. So that's the message for all the runners out there who thought it would last forever until it doesn't. Now go back to what the initial point was. Every choice you make has a consequence, every single choice in life. So think about if you're drinking water, why not drink juice? If you're drinking juice, why not organic juice? If you had 2, 3, 4 glasses of organic juice a day, that is just about as good as you can get for detoxifying and rejuvenating your cells, depending upon what's in the juice. That's also rehydrating the water in your body at the cleanest, purest, most mineral-rich, and electrolyte-rich capacity. You're also giving your body antioxidants. So when you do create free radicals, which we do, they're being trapped and neutralized. They become, when vitamin C courses through your body and it comes into contact with a free radical, it attaches to it and neutralizes the free radical. So hence the more antioxidants, more vitamin C, more vitamin E, more alpha lipoic acid, the more free radicals you trap, the less damage to your cell. The less damage to your cell, then you're feeding the cell what it needs to recover. You've got a young, new cell again. You're not going to be aging. You may be the same age as someone else chronologically, but biologically, you could be half their age. So listen to what I'm saying. The new 60 is 40. The new 70 is 45. The new 50 is 30, if you do it right. And this study is just one indicator that we can do it differently and do it right. And to all my friends now who have been runners in the past, don't run further or faster than what you're in immediate competition for, and then take a break and give 3 months rest afterwards. Now, you don't stop working. You just don't train hard for 3 months. And that way, your body has a chance to rejuvenate and recuperate. From Tufts University, there's a new study, and it talks about this beta cryptoxanthin. That's a carotenoid found primarily in red, orange, and yellow colored fruits and vegetables. And according to this study, it reduces lung cancer development and invasiveness in this laboratory experiment. So it inhibits nicotine-induced lung cancer. So think of the tens of millions of Americans that smoked. Think of people in our lives that smoked. Well, now by getting them to have, and here's how I would really help them, have them drink a juice each day. Now, here's what I would put in the juice. I would make the juice out of plums. There's your red. Red peppers. There's your red. Yellow peppers and zucchini, yellow squash. And then add in some purple. That would be your grapes. And that way, even purple potatoes, which are really good. By the way, I just made myself some purple potatoes last night. I'm preparing for a major film shoot this Friday, and it's for 2 weeks I'm going to be filming virtually every day to complete my new environmental film. And I'm filming all the real heavyweights on Friday, so I had to work on what do I want them to share in the film that can take a very complex issue and make it understandable to people, but also cover every base. Because the other films today are just, they're only covering global warming. They're not covering, for example, the acidification of our waterways and lakes, acid rain. In any case, I took a break, and I went in, and I had some purple potatoes. These are small. And first you wash the potatoes, then you put them in a steamer, and you let them steam for about, 5 minutes. So they're nice. You stick a knife in and out easily. And then I sautéed lightly at low temperature some garlic. And the thinner you slice the garlic or the more you dice the garlic, the more its healing comes forward. Then some chili peppers. I like a little hotter than most, so I dice them in. It's a little stronger than cayenne pepper. And then a combination of other, like rosemary, which is good, lemon, grate some lemon into this, and then saute the onions so everything is translucent. Then you put those potatoes, you cut the potatoes in half, and you put them in, and you stir-fry that with some black pepper and some Himalayan pink sea salt with olive oil. And that is absolutely delicious. And if you want to make it very exotic, put in some fresh, spicy tomato sauce. In fact, I do a double dish. I'll make my potatoes just like that. Then I put half aside, the side I'm going to eat right then and there, and I eat small portions. And then the other half, I put in a tomato sauce, stir it around, let it heat, turn off the flame. That's for lunch the next day. And that way you can have one preparation serving two meals of something most people would never think. Most people are not going to eat purple potatoes. And they're extremely rich in this very beta-cryptoxanthin carotenoid. So imagine if it inhibits nicotine-linked lung cancer development, then what would it do for a healthy lung? It makes it healthier. So just get this juice cut by, now here's the key, cut with red apples, meaning you put about 4 apples into a juice with some celery. Now you've got one of the most single, powerful, lung-enhancing, cancer-preventing, carotenoid-rich juices in nature. And that's what you ask the person who smokes or has smoked to drink once a day. And you could help save them from cancer, help save their life. And finally today, from Columbia University, actually I have two, one from Columbia University, deals with fruits and vegetables. And again, it just reconfirms what we've been believing and what many of you have been doing right. Think back at how long it's been since some of you have increased the amount of fruits and vegetables you're eating, either fresh, organic, locally, that's great. Organic frozen, that's good. Juicing, terrific. Concentrate, absolutely. Or most powerful of all, your compounded powders, which is everything that I just mentioned, but in more concentration. Any combination of that is great, but get them into your body each day. And you've been doing that. And that's why I've heard so many positive testimonials. In fact, first I want to thank all of you for, over the last 6 months, sending in photographs. About, I don't know, maybe 7, 8 months ago, I mentioned once on the air that we'd like to see what old photographs you have over the decades. And just send them in, and we would scan them and then send you back your copy. Well, we were flooded. And I've posted about 250 up on my Facebook page. And they're from, I've personally taken maybe 5%. All the rest of those are coming from people. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome you from all over the world. I'm Gary Knoll. On this evening's Progressive Commentary Hour, which is the most downloaded and listened to program I do all week, we're going to be talking about illegal activities of the international banking, offshore accounts, money laundering, and how such activities affect the lives of just ordinary people and threatens the global economy. My guest is Brad Birkenfeld, an American banker and a whistleblower who disclosed illegal operations of Swiss banks like UBS Bank and tax evasion and money laundering and exposed banking secrecy. And so we're going to talk to him about all of these people who end up putting money in the banks secretly. Who are they? We're going to ask for who are they, How illegal is it? And what can we do about it? I'd like to now share a personal letter to Michael Moore. Now, normally I would share this just by writing him, but because of Michael's advocacy of Hillary Clinton, I believe that everyone should become aware that there's a couple other issues that have not been discussed. And I don't believe Bill Maher is going to discuss them when he talks with, and certainly not people on MSNBC or some of the other programs. And I'll also be sharing some of the insights of Professor Henry Giroux. First up, let's just take a look at some of the films Michael has made. Capitalism, A Love Story. Who Should We Invade Next? Fahrenheit 9/11. Bowling for Columbine. And Sicko. Now, all of these have something in common. Michael Sicko, you talk about a system that is corrupt, that is influenced by those who value profit over any other quality, and you're correct. You highlighted something that just stuck with people, and that is the man who had to have only one finger sewed back on that was severed in an accident because he could not afford in the United States to have two. But in Canada, he would have had all of his fingers sewed back on at no cost to him. One example like that is worth as much as the rest of the film because it doesn't leave our mind. It's much like seeing that little girl with napalm burning her body, running naked on a street, terrified and in pain. One photograph does not ever leave the human consciousness. It's there, and it showed the grossness of the war. Or the man, the colonel, I believe, was shooting the bound Vietnamese in the head, and you actually see the trail of the smoke of the gun, and you see the man in his last second of life. And suddenly that can take someone who is neutral about a war and make them anti-war, because you're anti what you're seeing. It's what we don't see that doesn't impact us negatively. Another way of looking at it is if there was a child stuck in a water drain and the fire department was called out and everyone's there and everyone holds their breath. We're all waiting for that moment for the child to be rescued. And we breathe easier and we're happy. Well, what about the 27,000 children who die every 24 hours from the effects of starvation, dehydration, water infection, born disease? If we don't see them, how can we feel for them based upon how we're conditioned to feel? Only what's in our conscious. What if our conscious is constantly distracted? So in your movie, I commend you for what you did by showing us in Sicko what was wrong with our system. And Who Should We Invade Next? Showing us people living at a higher quality of life, better standard of living than what we had here. Even though we're richer and have more of everything, we seem to have less happiness and a shorter lifespan. And why we feel that we need to invade countries. The connections with Saudi Arabia and the Bush family in Fahrenheit 9/11, that was apparent. And anyone who had never made that connection, you allowed us. Bowling for Columbine, the argument was that the shooters shot because they had access, easy access to guns. It was a gun culture. Of course, I was happy to say that you also modified that position when I brought to your attention the footage that I just filmed for Drugging of Our Children, where they all said it was not the guns, it was the drugs, that they were normal. Their friends said they were normal until they started on the drugs, and then the more drugs they took, the more crazy they became until they became totally psychotic. And then attack people. You came into Prescription for Disaster to do a comment on that, and rightly so, and I appreciate that, as did the people who, when you were at the premiere down at the AMC Theater. But you got us to pay attention, got us to create a debate, a dialogue in the United States, a dialogue that's still continuing. And capitalism, remember when you were wrapping the tape around the front door of one of the banks, Bank of America, or one of them, and talking about people who are homeless That also got our attention. Now, what do all these have in common? That Hillary Clinton is the antithesis of everything that you've spent your adult career promoting. Her largest bundlers of money, Wall Street. The people that she voted to and or advocated to keep in power, the people bailed out on Wall Street. Show me a single home that she intervened to prevent from being foreclosed on. Just one. Now, we had over 7 million, so surely there might be one in 7 million. And all those students, if you were to do a film today on students and their debt, I'm sure you'd advocate for free tuition. She does not. In fact, the people who have helped her fundraising have been from the different private sector financial elite, including Wall Street. They've given her millions of dollars and then donated to her foundation in addition to that. And yet she would not provide us with the transcripts of what she was saying inside. So when it was leaked, it was, don't worry, there's two people. There's the private Hillary Clinton, and then there's the public Hillary Clinton. Don't worry about the public Hillary Clinton. It's what I believe privately that I'm sharing with you, because you and I are in alignment, and I'm not going to change Wall Street. To the contrary, my next Secretary of Treasury is going to come from you, just like my husband and I brought in Robert Rubin. And then we went ahead and we destroyed Glass-Steagall and the Future Commodities Trading Act, making it possible for you all to make these trillions of dollars. And did we once demand regulation when you were dealing in derivatives? No. Did I campaign against that as a senator? No. Oh, and when it comes to which country we should invade next, including 9/11, we now have absolute irrefutable proof that the Saudis were a part of the funding of 9/11. Well, if they were part of the funding, they had to be part of the planning. You're not going to fund what you're not aware of. No one walks up and says, we need $30 million. No problem. Don't you want to know what it's for? Why should I? Just take the money. No. The Saudis know where every dollar goes. They funded, they housed, they hid many of the 9/11 hijackers. That is a matter of fact. Who else was involved, to what degree United States officials knew, that is still open for investigation, and I don't want to speculate. So knowing that they were a part of that, knowing that Hillary Clinton has supported Saudi Arabia, knowing that she did not condemn their inclusion upon the U.S. United Nations Human Rights Committee, and yet they were last year the largest abusers of human rights in the world. They beheaded more people. They killed more gays. So I know, Michael, you definitely support gay rights, as I do. But how do you go on a stage saying, I support gay rights and Hillary Clinton's going to make America right again? And many of those gays, they're going to say, but hold on, why are you allowing Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Bahrain and other countries that actually cause imprisonment or death, being thrown off buildings or beaten to death or beheaded for being gay? How can you say you're for us when you're for us here? Is that the public person, but the private one is as long as Saudi Arabia is doing business? Well, doesn't that smack exactly against what you had in 9/11? So based upon your film 9/11, Fahrenheit 9/11, everything that Fahrenheit 9/11 represented, and you tugged it onto the Bushes, are actually the Clintons as well. She had closed more deals to sell more arms to Saudi Arabia than any other Secretary of State in American history. And she actually was recorded celebrating with the employees at the State Department when she closed those deals. Now, where do those arms go? Well, first, they go to make sure that an absolute monarchy in Saudi Arabia, there is no tolerance for any other religion, not Judaism, not Catholicism, which is a division of Christianity, none of those are allowed. They also have no rights for women except the few that are allowed. In many cases, a woman can show nothing more than her hands, but not her wrists, and their eyes. So how are you for women's rights, but not Saudi rights, or many other Muslim women's rights? Also, you're for children. That's what you claim. Of course you are. But what about the children in the countries that are being droned and bombed? A little disingenuous, in my opinion. So we're either connecting with a universal truth, Michael. And the only way I live is by universal truths. I don't give a damn about anyone's politics, beliefs. I don't give a damn about what anyone thinks of me. All I care is, am I living each day based upon a universal truth? And if I'm not, then I'm either going to shut up or I'm going to reevaluate my beliefs, because a truth that's universal means it applies to everyone equally. But her truths, Michael, as you are fully aware, are red carpet truths. Do you remember the day, Michael, that we were both at a premiere of Hotel Rwanda? You walk the red carpet? I wouldn't. I would never in my life walk a red carpet, because I consider it a denigration of everything that I value. It shows elitism, even if it's unconscious. I'm not blaming you for that. But our society's become one where the Hillary Clintons and everyone else, from celebrities to politicians to heads of businesses to athletes, believe that they're entitled to the red carpets of life, meaning they don't have to wait in line. They get everything at a privileged level. So how does that reconcile with she's going to make everything right? Is she going to give us tuition-free college? No, she's already stated such. All that she will do is she will modify somewhat the repayment schedule, but not the interest rates. Have you once seen her argue in behalf of people who are paying 500% interest for payday loans, 1,000% interest? No. But she's taking money from the companies that are making the payday loans. And what about the private prison system, Michael? You have advocated, rightly so, and I commend you for it, for those individuals who have been repressed because of class, race, and social standing. Can you give me one single example of Bill or Hillary Clinton, not in a campaign season, but in regular life, to go out and risk something, risk arrest, to protest? Did you see her out at the pipeline where others have gone? No. You have not. To the contrary, she says that she can count upon the black vote. What has she done to earn it? Show me the black lives that are improved because of her. Was she vigorous in fighting stop and search in New York? No. So you see, between your work, which I commend, and your support of hers, are you telling us that you believe so much in her to become the most powerful person in the world that suddenly everything that she has been in her past and will likely be in the future, that somehow we should forgive all that because she's going to be a new person? I don't believe she's going to be a new person. In fact, why is it that no one talks about the 15 years she was in private law practice? I looked up her client list, Walmart. She led the challenge to make sure that women did not have the kind of natural time to spend with their children when they were pregnant or just delivered. She was against raising their wage. She was against many of the other positions that the average person at Walmart, the largest employer of a company in the United States at that time, she was for Tyson Foods. Why don't you go up and Google Tyson Foods and all the problems they've had? TCBY, Stevens Inc., which is a huge brokerage firm. And wasn't it through Stevens Inc. that she made, through a broker there, $1,000 become $100,000? Try that. How did that happen? Worthen Bank, and wasn't she was also supported Monsanto? Didn't she represent Casa Grande Enterprises behind the Whitewater scandal? Wasn't one of the people who took the bullet and didn't testify against her, Susan McDonald, wasn't she pardoned? Interesting how many people, who, including Dan Lexeter and Bill Clinton's brother, and so many people that could have dropped a dime on the Clintons were pardoned. And Mark Rich, pardoned. So until such time that we hold the people that we're going to be the most powerful person in the world accountable for what they've done in the past, then we can only assume that they're not going to change their modus operandi or their behavior going forward in the future. In a couple of months, 2 months now, Michael, I'll be going to a Syrian refugee camp to try to bring them enough food, the pregnant women and their children, for anywhere from 3 to 6 months each, and work with them and the medical team who's invited me to help improve their nutrition so they don't die. Why don't you come? No cameras. Just be there every day. Not for an in and out in a day, but for the time it takes to really try to make a difference. As little a difference as it may ultimately make, because there are far more people needing help than we can help. And then see if that experience doesn't impact a little differently. Because if Hillary Clinton's elected, we're going to have 10 times more refugees. We're going to have environmental refugees, hundreds of millions out of Africa. We're going to have regime change refugees out of Iran, Syria. We're likely to have war refugees because of green lighting. And would you support Israel? Do you support of all Israel's positions against Palestinians? Because if you don't, she does. And that means that they will be held accountable to nothing and that you'll see further encroachment. So a vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for the suffering, continuing suffering, of the Palestinians. Think of the consequences. As the distinction, Michael, between the truth and lies fades in public life, politics appears to be increasingly emptied of any substance. That is, truth and evidence have gone the way of the electric typewriter. Americans seem to have a growing fondness for ignorance, but a love of celebrity. So we'll believe anything a celebrity tells us in our intended ignorance. And this is an attitude that reinforces the downsizing of the civic function of language. Falsehoods and deceptions no longer appear marginal to political debate, but now seem to shape much of what is said by those in power. Hillary Clinton, Michael, has earned a reputation as a chameleon, willing to say almost anything to promote her political career, regardless of whether she sacrifices the truth in order to do so. Her email scandal is largely read as symptomatic of a more pronounced and deeper level of dishonesty. Consequently, she's viewed mostly by the general public as untrustworthy. That is a gross understatement. But in response, she has managed her truth deficit by invoking her lifelong defense of families and children. For instance, during the second debate, she claimed she wanted, quote, an American to be for our children, and attempted to foster this by her concern for the welfare of children by pointing to her early work with the Children's Defense Fund. I did not hear anyone on NPR or PBS, or certainly not in MSNBC, actually do any homework. They had the resources to do, so it's an intended ignorance. But it shouldn't be. In the third presidential debate, she argued against Trump's call for exporting 11 million immigrants by stating that she was against his deportation policies because, quote, she didn't want to rip families apart and sending parents away from children. In her political television ads, she points to supporting policies that, quote, will invest in schools and colleges and develop an economy where every young American can find a job and start a family of their own, end quote. Unfortunately, Clinton only focuses on managing some of the problems the young people face. She never does a single thing to change the conditions that produce them. For instance, she says nothing about what education should accomplish in a democracy when educational policies are driven by a neoliberal economy that she fully supports. She is the ultimate cheerleader for neoliberalism, which means corporatism, which means globalization, which means the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Is that what you support more of, Michael? Because that's what you're getting. And while she talks about providing jobs for young people, she has little to say about transforming rather than adjusting an economy marked with wide gaps in inequality, wealth, and power. Matters of power and state violence and extreme poverty and institutional racism, a broken criminal justice system, the school, the prison pipeline, and the existence of the mass incarceration state, among their important matters, well, they're not at all in her discourse. And yet these are major issues negatively affecting the lives of millions of children in the United States. and her alleged regard for children falls apart in light of her hawkish policies on global regime change, drone attacks and cyber warfare, and her unqualified support for the warfare state. Her alleged support for children abroad does not capture the larger reality they face when their countries are invaded, they're attacked by our drones, and they're subjected to contemporary forms of indiscriminate violence. Rather than critique the U.S. as a powerful engine of violence, which it is, we're the most violent nation in the world, Clinton expands its imperialist role around the globe. This is a key point in light of her defense of the rights of children because her warmongering ideology puts children in the path of all lethal violence. At the same time, Clinton promises to address the problems many children face in the United States. That reeks of a disingenuousness made visible by her history of siding with and supporting completely policies that were injurious to children. Not only did she once disparagingly call young people super predators, but as First Lady, she strongly backed her husband's campaigns to end welfare as we know it. President Clinton's welfare policies did great harm to poor children. They eliminated the Aid to Families with Dependent Children's federally funded assistance program and infuriated Marianne Wright Edelman, the president of the Children's Defense Fund, to the degree that she ended her working relationship with Hillary Clinton. Why is that not discussed? According to Edelman, the bill represented a frontal assault on the well-being of poor children and families. Yet as late as 2008, Hillary is still touting this pernicious welfare bureau as a success. She also supported Bill Clinton's tough-on-crime policies, which, according to Michelle Alexander, quote, resulted in the largest increase in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history, which has a devastating effect on the families and children of color. And also, Clinton supported Bush's invasion of Iraq, the Patriot Act, and all that went with it, including the National Defense Authorization Act, the massive illegal spying on American citizens, which led, by the way, our Clinton's and Bush's act to the death of hundreds of thousands of children directly at her doorstep. So if you're saying that a woman has caused the death of 500,000 children in 1991 in Iraq, and millions of more suffering, displaced, and dead today, how does that fit into the role model of a person of compassion, humanistic values, or an elevated sense of morality? It does not. Occupying the right wing of the Democratic Party, Clinton has aligned herself with a war culture that supports drone warfare, continues to support military policies that result in the needless deaths of millions of children in the Middle East, Yemen, Somalia, and other places that bear the brunt of America's foreign policy. It's difficult to imagine, given Clinton's coziness with the financial elite, big corporations, the military-industrial complex, and the reigning war culture, that she will do anything that will lessen the violence to which children, both at home and abroad, and around the globe, will face under her potential reign as President of the United States. Clinton has nothing to say about the need for a collective struggle for economic and political justice. Given her past history, Clinton's disingenuousness becomes even starker next to the images of war and violence that mark the bodies of young, both in the United States and abroad. Her commitments to war are absolute. Her commitments to a phobic sense of Orwellian security is absolute, and it's built upon the misery, mutilations, and death of young people, and her recent alleged support for the welfare of children does little to cover up the many ways capitalism, militarism, state violence, and racism are killing poor and black young. But let's go a little further, Michael. The horrors of war become painfully visible when the image circulated of the lifeless body of Alan Kurdi, a 3-year-old who washed up on a beach face down in the coastal town of Bagram, Turkey, on September 2, 2015, while traveling with other refugees toward the Greek island of Kos. A second haunting image appeared on August 17, 2016, showing 5-year-old Amran, bloodied and covered with dust, sitting silently in an ambulance after an airstrike in Aleppo, a city in northern Syria. Ordinarily, such images of children dead, injured, or suffering motivate public outrage and also incite people to act. Omran's image was widely circulated by mainstream news organizations into the social media. The image provoked so much international outrage that the governments of Syria, China, and Russia claimed it was propaganda and staged. One of the most powerful images in history to provoke moral outrage and public anger was the image that circulated in 1955 of the grossly mutilated body of Emmett Till. That depiction of the effects of brutal racist violence helped to galvanize the civic rights movement. Civil rights then became the talking point of an entire conscious generation. Another image that changed the course of history was on display in 1972 when an anguished and terrified young girl was photographed running naked, as I mentioned earlier, after a napalm bomb burned and disfigured her body. The iconic picture played a significant role in mobilizing protests that helped stop the Vietnam War. Reactions to such horrible images still exist, but the brutal and unthinkable acts of violence they portray now seem to produce short-lived outrage and blend into the all-encompassing spectacle of violence in the fog of war. Have we become that desensitized? Have we become that removed, that removed? Are we that indifferent unless something affects us directly? What is crucial to acknowledge is that war has come home and has strapped many young people in its spiral of accelerated violence, which has become a new form of domestic terrorism and the primary force promoting a machinery of literal and social death for many youths. Domestic terrorism is now exemplified every day in media stories focusing on the killing of unarmed young people by the police and in the gun violence that is turning poor urban cities into war zones. Violence has become a habitual response by the state to every social problem. This has become more and more evident as the application of militarized police power produces on a daily basis a growing number of images of dead bodies, which increasingly find their way onto the screen cultures of the social media. In the U.S., according to Marion Edelman Wright's Children's Defense Fund, quote, 78 children under 5 died by guns last year, 30 more than the 48 law enforcement officers killed by guns in line of duty. In other words, Edelman writes, guns killed more preschoolers in 1 year than they did law enforcement officers. In Chicago alone, in the first 8 months of this year, 12 people were shot daily. Every U.S. soldier killed in Afghanistan during the last 11 years, at least 13 children were shot and killed in America. More than 450 kids didn't make it to kindergarten. Another 2,700 or more were killed by a firearm before they could sit behind the wheel of a car. Every day, on average, 7 children are shot dead. So what exactly is this meaning to this president? Just look at her companions in industries. Look at the propagandists in the media. The killing of children in America by U.S. forces abroad has become part of the politics of willful disappearance in which a culture of cruelty, immediacy, and forgetting works in tandem to eliminate any trace of the factors behind the production of violence in the service of the unthinkable, a society willing to sacrifice its own children in the industries that trade and profit in the massive production and distribution of guns. We are a war culture, and that becomes visible in the extreme violence captured in videos of the police killing of children, such as 12-year-old Tamara Rice, and adults such as Walter Scott, who was shot in the back as he was running away from his car by Michael Slanger, a white Charleston, South Carolina policeman. Young people, especially those considered the most suspect, provide a startling and eye-opening referent for analyzing not only how violence is represented and experienced, but also how it is distributed across a variety of interrelated sites. The daily violence experienced by youth, especially the most defenseless, does not often make news because it exposes the harsh brutalization and a reality that many youth face in a racist, homophobic, carceral, and market-driven society. Such indifference is all the more tragic since one of the most unspoken acts of collective violence in the United States resides in the treatment of its children. What I call the war on youth is alarming, given that the fate of a society's democracy is tied to the condition of its children. So what is the challenge? For those who are true progressives, including those who are on the conservative or the liberal spectrum, but have not aligned themselves with the rigidity of the corporatized capitalist system on both sides, there is hope. The current presidential race and the debates have provided, make it clear that both the Republican and Democrat Party have put forth meaningless reforms. Nothing will change. Nothing of the economic, social, or ethical conditions that produce the Trumps or the Clintons will change. If children matter, as Clinton has argued, then it's crucial to recognize that her concerns are highly disingenuous because she refuses to dismantle capitalism as it exists and fight for a social order that is no longer ruled by the commanding institutions that serve the financial elite and the dictates of global neoliberalism. If young people are to be viewed as a crucial measure of a substantive democracy, it is imperative to take seriously what it means to create a society that addresses their needs and opens up a better future than the one the established political and financial elites have created for them. There is only one candidate that can do that, and that is Jill Stein. She is capable and willing. Will it happen this time? No, it will not. But a vote for her sends a very strong message that we're no longer willing as a society to support the lesser of two evils, the sociopathic, narcissistic, homicidal maniacs, the perpetual liars, the deceivers, those who have blended themselves into a pit of rattlesnakes. Rattlesnakes are not immune to each other's venom, but they all know how to coexist, 10,000 in a single cave together, without one biting the other. However, as they sanctify their rule, their imperial overreach to the American citizens, and we see that when we take a look at how we're facing Indians, Native Americans, asking for their tribal lands, their sacred sites, not to be violated, and how the only response was not the President of the United States going there with Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or anyone else and saying, this is not the way we should solve our problems. Because, Michael, if you're not out there supporting those Native Americans, and you're not out there supporting the stopping of all this hydrofracking, then ask this, why haven't they decided to put a pipeline under the burial sites of Caucasians? Why not under one of the military burial sites? How long do you think that would go? America would be outraged. Everyone in Congress would protest. How many members of Congress have you seen there? How many members of the media have been there to challenge it, not just report on it? So those are some thoughts I have for you. So you and I have known each other for a long time. I would hope that the day comes when you stop looking as you did when you abandoned Ralph Nader, and you look at the greater good, not the lesser of evils. The greater good is a humanistic, spiritual, cooperative alignments of all the people in this country and around the world who believe that working together with our strengths means that in the next set of elections, at the local level, at the county level, state level, the federal level, more and more progressives become elected and therefore start to change. And we can also start collective protest. We can start collective boycotts. We can show them that we, the people, matter because we understand inequality. We understand that even given the opportunity to exploit, we would not do it. Given the opportunity to walk a red carpet, we would not do it. Given the opportunity to have an extra portion, we would first think, what if the person has no portion? How could I feel about myself if I'm eating twice and another person has nothing? These are the deeper issues. Isn't it time that the neoliberal community ask itself, do you have any moral responsibility at all for the use of your power? I hope that you reflect on these issues, Michael. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening.